You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippy.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, James Schneider, the editor of Think Africa Press, is here to help us set the day's news agenda. James, what are we talking about today?
We're going to be discussing a major victory against rebels in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, asking whether growth alone is enough for African economies, and investigating the plight of African migrants coming to Europe.
More from James a little later. Also on the program, we'll be discussing the importance of the Serb voter turnout to Kosovo's municipal elections this Sunday, with the former Secretary of State for Kosovo in Serbia.
Also ahead, is the world running out of wine? We'll assess the implications of a Morgan Stanley report that predicts a wine drought in the coming years with leading wine expert Jancis Robinson.
Plus, we'll find out how foodie filmmakers have combined their two passions into a film, El Somni.
I understand this like the wedding of opera and gastronomy coming together. We make this opera in 12 courses, and each course has a story inside.
All that plus we play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy program ahead, but before, here is Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
Monocle 24 News. US Secretary of State John Kerry has publicly admitted for the first time that the National Security Agency went too far in some of its intelligence gathering. Mr. Kerry told an international summit the NSA had been operating on automatic pilot rather than under full control of the government. He said he'd learned things about what the agency had been doing only recently, even though some of its spying programs had been going on for some time. Mr. Kerry said he'll work with President Barack Obama to prevent any more inappropriate acts by the NSA. Indonesia has summoned Australia's ambassador over reports that Australian embassies have been used as part of a US-led spying network in Asia. The Sydney Morning Herald newspaper has reported that diplomatic posts in Asia were being used to intercept phone calls and data. China has also demanded an explanation from the United States over the allegations. The reports were based on an NSA document leaked by whistleblower Edward Snowden. Indonesia's Foreign Minister Marty Natalegawa says he's concerned about his country's future relationship with Australia.
The fact that we have certain countries may have certain capacities to gather information in the way that they have, that's one thing, but whether you would want to put that into effect and therefore potentially damaging the kind of trust and confidence that have been nurtured and developed over many decades and years is something that we may want to ponder.
Israeli warplanes have attacked a military target inside Syria. US security officials say the attack happened at the port city of Latakia and targeted a shipment of Russian-made surface-to-surface missiles. Al Arabiya Television in Dubai say the missiles were consigned to Hezbollah in Lebanon. The UK-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights say the explosions took place on Wednesday. A senior Chinese security official says a crash in Beijing's Tiananmen Square was incited by the East Turkestan Islamic Movement. The crash happened on Monday when a car was driven into a crowd, then burst into flames, killing three people inside the vehicle and two tourists. Police have arrested five suspects, all from the western region of Xinjiang. Supporters of Egypt's ousted Islamist president Mohamed Morsi have called for daily protests to start today in the lead-up to his trial. Mr. Morsi was ousted by the army in July. He's due to appear in court on Monday with 14 other senior Muslim Brotherhood figures charged with inciting violence. It's feared the call for protests over the next 3 days will prompt more violence. The trial could also further inflame tensions between the Brotherhood and Egypt's army-backed interim government. US food aid benefits are being cut following the expiry of an extension of the government's program, while legislators fight over further cuts. Benefits to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, will be lowered by $36 a month for a family of four. Around 47 million Americans on low incomes will be affected by the cuts. One in seven Americans relies on SNAP, also known as food stamps. A drug-smuggling supertunnel has been discovered by US officials linking Tijuana in Mexico to San Diego. Authorities say it would have cost millions of dollars to complete. 8.5 tons of marijuana and 327 pounds of cocaine were seized during the raid. Three men were also arrested. The tunnel linked warehouses in Tijuana and San Diego's Otay Mesa industrial area. Homeland Security Special Agent Derek Benner says it was a very sophisticated operation.
This complex underground passageway zigzags for about a third of a mile under the border at a depth of approximately 35 feet on average. The passageway is 4 feet in height, it's approximately 3 feet wide, and it's equipped with an electronic rail system, an elaborate electrical system, as well as a ventilation system.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill Bingham. It is 17:06 in Tokyo, 12:06 in Moscow, 8:06 here in London. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
Londres. Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada se che che che.
From London,
London, London,
cara. De long, de long.
This is Monocle 24. Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie. It's time now to tell you the three big stories you should keep in mind today. Well, joining us in the studio is James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. James, welcome to the program. Shall we begin with this new story, a new report from the IMF over growth in the African continent?
Yes. Yeah, so the IMF has slightly revised down, but it's an increase on this year. It's forecast for sub-Saharan Africa's growth next year to across the continent slightly over 6%. And they're trying to, but they're saying, watch out, it's not all necessarily good, because their increased threat to decreasing commodity prices and to capital flows leaving the continent as America calms down its quantitative easing.
Looking at individual African countries, are there any surprising ones?
Well, not really, but the IMF is trying to drag out a few examples to try to make it seem that the African growth story isn't just commodities led. And so they've taken essentially a few countries like Mozambique, which are post-conflict countries, which haven't yet seen big commodity thing, although Mozambique has gas coming online pretty soon. But they're using these to try to say that it's not just commodities, that there's lots of other things going on. Look, all the things that we've been saying countries should be doing, like what they call prudent macroeconomic policy, bringing down inflation, things like that, are having a really good effect. But if you look at it in the aggregate, it really is just still a commodity story. And the thing that is worrying is that it's not just a commodity story, it's in there taking more stuff out of the ground and getting it to market. It's really the amount that's coming out the ground is pretty similar, and it's just the prices that are higher. And the things that were really going to make economic growth sustainable, broad-based, and provide employment, which is low-end manufacturing, that isn't coming. The percentage of African across the continent, African GDP, which comes from exporting light manufacturing, is 5%. And it was 5% in 1995. There's been no change. So throughout this whole Africa rising narrative, which has seen very good growth and good economic development across the continent in some ways, the bit that will make it sustainable hasn't been kicking in.
You mentioned tapering there from the US government and concerns over just how much foreign countries are going to be investing in the African continent. Of course, if the US does ease off on quantitative easing, what's the US's loss perhaps is China's gain. You know, we've been talking a lot about the influx of Chinese money on the African continent. What role are they playing in all of this?
Well, I mean, it may be their game, but one of the threats that the IMF are highlighting is that is the slowdown in emerging markets. So if the US is tapering off its quantitative easing, that will have an effect in the emerging markets, the major emerging markets like China, which might limit their demand for African commodities. So a really big part of the African growth story over the last few years has been the increased demand from China, mainly China, but also other emerging economies. And another fear now is as the Chinese economy tries to become more internal demand driven and less export driven, that the demand for African commodities might taper off as well.
Do you think the IMF are being a bit too pessimistic in this report? Because they are stating growth figures of 6%. And those are growth figures that the Europeans and the Americans would die for.
Okay, but you have to look at what the base is. So this is 6% from, generally GDP per capita of $1,500. So this is 6% from a really low base. And it's also a 6% that is perhaps more reversible and less robust, given that it's not providing the broad-based manufacturing. And also, growth figures alone are just not enough if you have, for example, Nigeria's been experiencing very strong growth the last decade, and absolute poverty has gone up about 6%. And so unless you're taking into account the increase in manufacturing, increase in employment, and also how the economy is being formalized, the huge sections of the African economies fall outside of what we would call the economy. They're informal.
James, shall we move to your second story? The Army of the Democratic Republic of Congo claims to have beaten back M23 rebels. Encouraging news from there. What does this mean for the country?
It's really quite a remarkable turnaround, which no one was really expecting. The real speed and the success, and if it does finish off defeating the M23, it will pretty much be the first time that the Congolese military has defeated any rebel group and any serious rebel group. And it will also mean that Rwanda doesn't have a proxy, is perhaps too strong a word, but doesn't have a party that they are supporting in Eastern Congo for the first time since the mid-90s. So it does represent a really big potential sea change if the gains are sustained. And also it represents a kind of new model for how the UN can deal with particular conflict situations. So this is a victory that's been won by the Congolese military alongside a UN force which has a much more aggressive mandate than most peacekeeping forces. It actually has a mandate to engage and fight with the rebel group. So it could have very big impact. However, we'd still need to say that without some kind of overall peace agreement that needs to be reached, even though they're not holding very much territory, because Rwanda still has the capability to create another rebel group or support another rebel group or reform the M23, unless its legitimate security concerns in the region are addressed, then any kind of peace windfall might be short-lived.
Because we have heard these kind of claims before, saying that the M23 were on the brink of collapse. Earlier this week as well, we heard from the Rwandan government saying that if the shelling from the Congolese army near the Rwandan border continues, that they'll not stand by and watch that happen. You mentioned those peace negotiations. It seems to play the optimist that there is some positive news out there. They have reached 8 out of 11 of the outstanding issues when it comes to these peace negotiations, but I guess the three outstanding ones are the most important.
Yeah, so there's not been a final agreement. There's a problem with a lot of the M23 senior rebels. They can't really be integrated into the Congolese military. So there's the real question of what happens to the M23 leadership. Lots of people have been suggesting that basically they're going to be given some kind of payoff, but it's working a way around it so that they can be paid off, which is difficult. But now they're going to be in a much weaker bargaining position because of sustained international support for the Congolese position and sustained criticism of Rwanda. The M23 have less room to maneuver than they have had before.
After that relatively Good story. We continue with something sadder. We've been hearing news of immigrants trying to reach Europe who are drowning in the Mediterranean, but people are also dying of thirst in the Sahara when they're trying to reach Algeria.
Yeah, and we've seen, yeah, exactly as you say, there's this horrendous story of about 90 people who've been found in the Sahara who were trying to reach Algeria. It's not clear whether they were trying to stay in Algeria when they got there or there was an onward journey to Europe. And this is something that both North African countries and European counterparts need to work out collectively together. There's a real problem with how European countries are working with each other. So if people arrive in Italy, sometimes the Italian authorities will give them a train ticket to just bump them up to Germany. And there's a problem of in Spain, there's a different rate for Sudanese asylum seekers. They'll be granted it or they won't be granted it, to a different rate to Italy. And so you have all of these kind of weird, perverse incentives. And at the same time, these tragedies continue. Hundreds of people a year are drowning in the Mediterranean trying to flee something or reach a better life. And generally, it is flee something. And these are people who have spent quite a considerable amount of money trying to get there. So the narrative which you sometimes hear in Europe of, oh, we're just trying to be swamped by illegal immigrants trying to come here and take jobs, etc., just doesn't work at all. I mean, it's pretty much the opposite on the facts on the ground.
That was James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. Thank you very much for this.
Coming up after this very short break, we'll be asking if a wine drought is really looming. But first, we head to Kosovo to find out how this weekend's local elections are key to the relationship between Serbia and Kosovo.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe. The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time is 17:17 in Tokyo. It's 10:17 in Istanbul and 8:17 here in London. Now, Kosovo is having municipal elections on Sunday, and for the first time, these elections include a small Serbian populated pocket in the north, which had resisted the integration to the rest of the country since it declared independence in 2008. Well, that was until now.
Last April, Serbia gave up its de facto hold over Kosovo in a landmark agreement, yet the division between ethnic Serbs and the rest of the population of Kosovo remains. A strong turnout among the Serb voters would signal backing for the peace process between Kosovo and Serbia, but officials are worried that many will boycott the polls to show their suspicions over the new deal. Well, to discuss this further, we are joined by our Belgrade correspondent Guy Deloni, who is on his way to Kosovo for Monocle as we speak, and Oliver Ivanovic, Serb leader in Kosovo. Guy, if we start with you, could you tell us about the general mood in Kosovo? As I already mentioned, there is even a campaign to boycott the elections.
Well, I've been speaking to contacts in Kosovo in the days coming up to the election, and the mood seems to be that a lot of people aren't particularly sure about the election one way or another. I've been told that a lot of people are deciding that this weekend might be a really good weekend to go and visit their relatives in different parts of Serbia, as it's nice weather, and this way you're really not going to have to make that decision about whether you're going to vote or not. The key thing seems to be, what's good for people's lifestyle? This is going to be the main question that people have to ask themselves. An awful lot of the people in North Kosovo, in the Serb community, are employed in one way or another by the Serbian public sector. And they've got to work out whether it's better for them to vote, to turn out and vote for people who are standing on these various Serb lists in the municipal elections, and would that ensure their future income and their family's way of living, or is it better for them to boycott and say, no, no, we do not accept these elections held by the Republic of Kosovo. We absolutely want to remain part of Serbia.
Oliver, I just want to pose a question to you now. Of course, I know that you are pro-election as a Serb leader in Kosovo, but a recent report by the UN has these rather startling figures. Only 16% of Kosovo Serbs plan to vote, and some 44% say that they will boycott the election altogether. How much legitimacy do you think that these elections can actually hold?
Legitimacy is mentioned just by the politicians and political analysts. In reality, in daily life, legitimacy is not anything important to us, because in Kosovo you can get the legitimacy among the Serbs only if you get a huge number of the votes, what's never happening, or you have the full support and recognition by Serbia. That's something what we are seeking. That's why I think that legitimacy is going to be put forward only if the local administration is not doing well. If that happened, you can have many questions, and everyone will start with legitimacy.
The Serbian government is pushing its own candidate list. How do you feel about that?
That's not democratic. That's not a state policy. That's a political party policy, and I'm strongly against. But I can understand to some extent, you know, why the Serbian parties, at least the Vulin himself, is pushing so much. He's planning to build up the party and starting from Kosovo. That's the old recipe which works. You know, sensitivity for the Kosovo, emotion for the Kosovo is widely spread. And by starting here, he's just taking attention on himself. And he can use that popularity, in brackets, you know, for the future action towards building up his own party. Unfortunately, that's damaging us, because by favoring one party, you are antagonizing the others. That's something what Vulin is supposed to have in mind. If he's not, at least there's some other higher leader, stronger leader, are supposed to do that. Because we will continue to fight each other even after the election, what is wrong and bad for the Serb future in Kosovo.
Guy, let's just turn to you. Of course, the key part of these elections were because of a peace deal that was reached earlier. How much of this is weighing on the minds of the Serbian government when it comes to EU ascension?
Well, the talks process for membership of the European Union is just getting underway now. We've got the preliminaries starting up, and you'll have the full membership talks probably starting in January. Now, it's no secret that a condition of these talks going ahead is that Serbia shows willing on this normalization of relations with the Republic of Kosovo. Nobody is asking Serbia to actually officially recognize the independence of the Republic of Kosovo for the moment, but they are asking them to show that they're serious about this normalization of relations, and part of that is showing that they want ethnic Serbs in North Kosovo and other parts of Kosovo as well to turn out in these elections. So it's very important for the government to be seen to be getting hard behind the election process if they want to keep the EU membership talks on track. You talked about turnout before. It'll be very interesting to see what an acceptable level of turnout will be. I mean, these are local elections, so you wouldn't necessarily expect a massive turnout in any case. The voter list is years out of date, so there'll be lots of people on the list who don't live in Kosovo or in those municipalities anymore. So I think everybody, particularly in Serbia, but I think you'll see from the Pristina and also the Brussels sides as well, will be keen to say, this has worked. We've had a legitimate election in North Kosovo, and now we've got legitimately elected representatives there.
Well, Guy, just one final question for you. You mentioned there that the Serbian government has to be seen to be doing things, seen to be wanting to normalize relations, but there's a real difference between being seen as doing something and actually wanting to do something. And I only say that because just last week there was an arrest warrant issued for a Serbian government minister who came to the north of Kosovo and, you know, was brandishing an army uniform and waving the Serbian flag. So how much do the Serbians actually want this?
Well, this is Aleksandar Vulin that Mr. Ivanovic was just mentioning there. As Mr. Ivanovic said, there's a lot of power plays going on here. The government, and Mr. Vulin in particular, is in a bit of a bind. They want to say that they support Serbian people, that they support Serbia, that Kosovo, as far as they're concerned, remains part of Serbia, and those Serb citizens in Kosovo are still Serbian citizens, but at the same time trying to play nice with Brussels. As you can imagine, this is a tremendous balancing act which they're doing, and there are certain things which are displayed in order to appeal to different audiences. That's what's going on here. I think it's interesting it was Aleksandar Vulin that's doing that, and not Aleksandar Vučić, who's the most powerful politician in Serbia. He's going to one of the Serbian municipalities in the south of Kosovo today. He won't be waving around any Serbian flags. I can absolutely guarantee you of that.
That was our Belgrade correspondent Guy Deloney, who is on his way to Kosovo now, and Oliver Ivanovic, Serb leader in Kosovo.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Oplondo, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Now, whether it's a nice warm Cabernet with some Wagyu beef or perhaps a crisp Riesling on a hot summer day, a nice glass of wine goes down a treat in nearly every situation and sometimes can even be your best friend. But for all you wine lovers out there, you might need to start panicking and start hoarding your favorite bottle. The world is starting to run out of wine. Dun dun dun.
According to a new report, at least, the world is facing a wine shortage, with global demand significantly outstripping supply. There was demand for nearly 300 million cases more than there was supply. So, should we prepare for the inevitable and stash our corkscrews? To discuss this further, we are delighted to say we are joined by one of the world's leading wine experts, Jancis Robinson, co-author of The World Atlas of Wine, that has its seventh edition out just now. Welcome to the programme, Jancis. So, essentially, does this report mean that I should rush out of the studio after the programme and go and empty the shelves of my local wine shop?
Absolutely not. No, the report's based on rather out-of-date figures. It's true that the 2012 vintage was pretty small in France, but actually was quite good in a lot of other places. And now we've got the 2013 vintage in, and the preliminary figures on that show that it's much bigger than the 2012 vintage, and that consumption and production are pretty much back in sync now. The fact is that for most of my wine writing life, the world has been producing far, far too much wine, far too much not very good basic wine, a lot of which in Europe in particular had to be distilled compulsorily. Turned into sort of industrial alcohol. And the EU's been working quite hard at reducing the number of not very good vineyards in Europe so that we have just about got things back into the right kilter now.
Well, Jancis, it's a fact that China and the US are drinking more wine than ever before. And at the same time, there is more wine production. What are the, say, new countries where the wine's coming from? Who are the new producers?
Well, China has been shown, as in so many fields, the most dramatic growth and is now the world's sixth biggest grower of grapevines. Chile has been expanding its production significantly, as has the United States. But it's important to remember that the three biggest wine markets, which are the three biggest wine producers, France, Spain and Italy, have been dramatically reducing their consumption of wine.
And when we talk about the production of wine, it really is a battle, isn't it, between these old world regions in Europe and much of the new world regions like South Africa, the US and Chile.
Yeah, but the great thing for us consumers is that it is a competitive market, and people only stay in that market if they make better wine every year. So actually we wine drinkers have benefited enormously by increasing quality and a competitive market of all producers wanting our dollar. So in real terms, actually, as I will be writing in my Financial Times article tomorrow, wine has actually gone down in price.
And chances when we are seeing new wine manufacturers, thanks to the climate change, thanks to new production techniques, you can nowadays make wine in areas where it wasn't possible before. How should we feel about these new wines from new areas? Are they any good?
Some, yes. Who would have thought that Sweden would have vineyards, say, 20 years ago? But I had a rather delicious ice wine from Sweden not long ago. And then as people in the tropics and closer to the equator get more and more sophisticated about producing wine from vineyards in a tropical climate, if you go on holiday to Thailand or Vietnam, you can find, or India, you can find perfectly drinkable wine there made locally.
And Jensis, it is a Friday evening here in London at least. What's your selection or your pick for the best moderately priced of red wine that maybe I should take for dinner tonight?
Funnily enough, every Friday I choose a wine of the week on my website, jensisrobinson.com. If you were in the US, my pick today is a fantastic New Zealand underpriced Pinot Noir, Mountford Village 2008 Pinot Noir, which is going for just $18 in some American retailers. But I think if you were anywhere else, you should go for last week's pick, which is a ridiculously underpriced Spanish red, Telmo Rodrigo's Almuvedra, which is made in Alicante on the Spanish coast, and is made from Mourvedre, the very posh grape that makes Bondol, and it's much less than £10 a bottle.
Well, I think I have an idea of what I will be doing tonight, and I think I also have an idea of what Phil will be doing after this program.
Jensis
Robinson, co-author of The World Atlas of Wine, thank you so much for coming onto the show. In the next half hour of the program, we'll check in with our woman in Bamako. We'll browse through the Italian front pages, and we'll also be in Spain for a foodie film preview.
Within this space, there are the parameters of pain, of war, of anguish, about sex, about carnality, and on the regeneration of life. In the end, they are issues that usually are hard to understand in a restaurant.
But first, here is Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has publicly admitted for the first time that the National Security Agency went too far in some of its intelligence gathering. Mr. Kerry told an international summit the NSA had been operating on automatic pilot rather than under full control of the government. He said he'd learned things about the agency and what it had been doing only recently, even though some of its spying programs had been going on for some time. He says he'll work with President Barack Obama to prevent any more inappropriate acts by the NSA. Indonesia has summoned Australia's ambassador over reports that Australian embassies have been used as part of a US-led spying network in Asia. The Sydney Morning Herald newspaper has reported that diplomatic posts in Asia were being used to intercept phone calls and data. China has also demanded an explanation from the United States over the allegations. Israeli warplanes have attacked a military target inside Syria. US security officials say the attack happened at the port city of Latakia and targeted a shipment of Russian-made surface-to-surface missiles. Al Arabiya Television in Dubai said the missiles were consigned to Hezbollah in Lebanon. A senior Chinese security official says a crash in Beijing's Tiananmen Square was incited by the East Turkestan Islamic Movement. The crash happened on Monday when a car was driven into a crowd, then burst into flames, killing three people inside the vehicle and two tourists. Supporters of Egypt's ousted Islamist President Mohamed Morsi have called for daily protests to start today in the lead-up to his trial. Mr. Morsi was ousted by the army in July. He's due to appear in court on Monday with 14 other senior Muslim Brotherhood figures charged with inciting violence. U.S. food aid benefits are being cut following the expiry of an extension of the government's program, while legislators fight over further cuts. Benefits to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, will be lowered by $36 a month for a family of four. One in seven Americans relies on SNAP, also known as food stamps. A drug smuggling supertunnel has been discovered by US officials linking Tijuana in Mexico to San Diego. Authorities say it would have cost millions of dollars to complete. 8.5 tons of marijuana and 327 pounds of cocaine were seized during the raid. 3 men were also arrested. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill. Bill will be back in about 25 minutes with another check of your world headlines. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 12:34 in Moscow. It's 8:34 here in London and also in Bamako. And that's where we're headed next to speak to our Mali correspondent, Alex Duval-Smith. Welcome to the program, Alex. Where shall we begin this morning?
Well, I think it's one of the big stories coming out of this region this week has been the release of the four French hostages, Pierre Legrand, Daniel Laribe, Thierry Doll, and Marc Ferré, who you'll recall arrived in France after being released in a deal that was negotiated by the government, chiefly the government of Niger and its contacts.
And what is the latest on that story? Now there's actually all of a sudden not as much excitement as there was before.
Yeah, well, initially, of course, there was the great excitement about the men's release and reunification with their families. But I think what's interesting now and what has caught my attention in the wake of the big discussion about whether ransom money was paid, which became a bit of a media fixation immediately after they arrived in France, is actually the political price that's been paid for these hostages' release. Because not only is it now becoming fairly clear, and we're hearing this from high-ranking Tuareg rebel leaders here in Mali and in Niger, so it's not only clear that a ransom amount was paid, probably up to 20 million euros, either by Areva, the uranium company, or by Vinci, the building company that the men were working for. But also, there have been various political deals. And in particular, Tuareg, there's a quite renowned Tuareg leader in the region, Yed Agali, who is the leader of Ansar Dine, the Defenders of Islam. And the word that's out now is that he's been guaranteed immunity from prosecution, and that could have far-reaching consequences because the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court is here at the moment, and obviously looking at how the legal aftermath of the Malian war is going to be dealt with. So, you know, we haven't finished dealing with the consequences of that hostage release yet.
Well, Alex, it does sound quite astounding, doesn't it? Some 20 million euros, perhaps. But more importantly, as you mentioned, the political backroom dealings over this deal. What was it about these four French hostages that made them so important?
Well, I think they're French, is the short answer. Because France, even though President François Hollande has made it clear that France does not pay ransom money anymore, France as a whole and France including its corporates are now kind of tarred with that brush of being paying ransom, and in this region, if you're white and Western, people do tend to take the view, you know, even if it's sort of jokingly, oh well, you know, if you're French, you're worth €1 million. If you're British, you're not worth anything because the Brits don't negotiate. You know, there's rather sort of bad taste jokes that go around in this part of the world. But yeah, I mean, France has paid ransom and France hasn't managed to shake it off, it would appear.
Let's move forward, shall we? Let's talk about Amadou Sanogo, who was the army captain who led a coup against Mali's elected president Touré in March 2012. That coup indirectly led to the war in Mali, and now it is being reported that Sanogo has been summoned before a judge in Bamako. Is this the first step towards the former coup leader facing justice?
Well, that's what the pressure group Human Rights Watch is saying this morning, welcoming the move. There had been a sense that Sanogo is going to get off scot-free. Just to quickly remind you, Amadou Sanogo was a captain in the army in March 2012 when the coup took place, and he led the coup claiming that essentially the government of Mali was neglecting the army and not making it possible for the army to defend the country against the forces of the Islamists and the secessionists in the north, and in which there's some truth, it has to be said, but he also appears to have had political ambitions and not to have let those go. So in the few days between the departure of the transitional government here in August this year and President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita's swearing in, Captain Sanogo Ogo became a four-star general, Sanogo. And so we'd assumed that the signal being sent by President Keita, the new democratically elected president of Mali, was that he was going to do exactly what all the other Malian presidents have been doing for 20 years, and which is what's got this country into the mess it's in partly, which is eternally promote army top brass to avoid a military coup, because they've been living in fears of military coups, and that has been one of the ways around it. Just give people more and more stripes on their shoulders and they won't bother you if you're a politician. So that had been the assumption. Now Sanogo's been called before a judge. That's all that's happened. He hasn't been charged, and we don't know if charges will ensue. But let's say it's a good step. It's a good step.
And Alex, finally, just one more story for you. The CFA franc, perhaps the downfall of the franc in West Africa?
Well, probably too soon to say, but the leaders of central banks from 15 West African countries have just finished meeting in Dakar, the capital of Senegal, and have decided to create a new single currency for the region. And this single currency would not just be the CFA franc, which is the one that's used here in Mali and has been in use for nearly 60 years in French-speaking countries. It would also be used in other countries of the region, 15 countries, and they will include Nigeria and Ghana. Nigeria and Ghana being much stronger economies than most of those in the region. So it's too soon to say that the CFA franc is on the way out, but it's possible to at least predict that perhaps a more competitive joint single currency is going to be introduced in due course.
Alex, I recall you having a Jack Russell, and I think he may be warning you that someone may be at your door. So we'll leave you now and to check out that situation. Alex Duval-Smith, our woman in Bamako.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this. We're at with a very special film preview, and it may make you hungry.
Learning from a master is a privilege in any sphere. To nurture ideas for the arts, Rolex's Mentor and Protégé initiative has been teaming leading practitioners with promising protégés around the globe. Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound hopped over to Venice to talk to some protégés and mentors.
Everybody's moved out of institutional thinking and behavior and moved into something that's way easier, more honest, more direct, and more collaborative. As an artist, it's not interesting to be a private genius. What you want is to be part of a movement.
You can watch Rob Bound's film on monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi, and Phil Hahn. Film and gastronomy, it is admittedly a marriage made in foodie heaven, but often a difficult recipe to pull off. Nonetheless, an ambitious new film from Barcelona, El Somni, is bringing the two together and throwing in other ingredients such as music, art and opera for good measure. Centered around the boundless creativity of the team behind El Cele de Can Roca in Girona, which this year was crowned as the world's best restaurant, it is intended to be a reflection on our senses and examine the transversal nature of food beyond our taste buds.
We've been talking a lot about food and wine on this program. I don't know if I can take any more. It's only 8:43 in London. I need it to be like 10 p.m.
You'll get your food and drink after this.
Well, Marcus, our correspondent Liam Aldis was invited to an exclusive of the preview of the film, and that is set for early release next year. Well, Liam talked to the team bringing this sensory feast to the silver screen for this week's episode of The Menu.
Oh, yeah.
El Sierra Can Roca has been under the spotlight for all the right reasons this year, winning first place on the coveted World's 50 Best Restaurant list. It's a tough act to follow, but the ever-focused and surprisingly humble Roca brothers haven't just been basking in the international limelight. They've also been busy translating their gastronomic wonder and creative processes to the big screen. In a collaboration with the Barcelona City Council, it's a bold fusion between gastronomy, art, and music that hopes to contribute to the perpetual discussion about food, a discussion which has evolved from a need into a desire. It's titled El Somni, which in Catalan means the dream.
It's attempting to be an example of creative transversality, as well as providing new ideas on our capacity to feel about where we are in the world of sensory science, and that there is possibly a new trend emerging showing that sometimes cuisine can be accompanied by storytelling.
I'm talking to Giuseppe Roca, sommelier and part owner of El Sierra Can Roca. He is articulating the film's ambitious vision, but as he explains, it's one that has allowed his restaurant in Girona to project their philosophy beyond the kitchen, a philosophy which is intrinsically linked to many of the emotions explored in the film.
It starts from the feeling of success and how to break with success, how to search out failure, and how to find the driving force in gastronomy and mix the art of eating and drinking with other artistic disciplines. The film attempts to summarize 6 months of collaboration between more than 60 creative figures from different creative fields. And in this case, we are attempting to show that cuisine is emotional. We want to show the world that from the loyalty of taste, we are able to forge different approaches to creativity.
Something that as well you often talk about is the social dimension of your restaurant. It's not just about food and high quality produce. There's a big social dimension. So how does the film contribute to that philosophy?
El Somni attempts to represent that which we could only really pull off creatively with great difficulty inside our restaurant. Here we have tried to explore these limits and what they represent in a restaurant that seeks to create a sense of well-being. And within this space, there are the parameters of pain, of war, of anguish, about sex, about carnality, and on the regeneration of life. In the end, they are issues that usually are hard to understand in a restaurant. El Somni has also allowed us to eat feeling pain, eat thinking about death, or thinking about sensuality in the strongest way possible. We use tools that you would hardly find in a restaurant, but which you can see in the movie.
It's almost like you never think it's possible, because when you go to a restaurant and you eat good food, you eat very good food and you enjoy the experience, but you never talk about it in terms of emotion. It's amazing how a single thought, a single piece of art, like visual art, and a single piece of item of food in front of you can make you feel like that.
The film's director, Franca Leo, may hail from the world of opera, but his eye for spectacle has helped unite the visceral delights of food cinematography and art with the oral pleasures of music and opera.
This movie tries to be just a portrait of a process where has been involved a lot of people, different talents and different arts coming together. For me, it's like the wedding party of opera and gastronomy. And then it's all kind of feelings inside. Every course have a meaning for us.
Are there parallels between each spectacle, between an opera and perhaps the three courses of a meal? Do you think the two have more in common than we might think?
For me, opera is the art that makes all the art together. Wagner says that. And Batel, François Batel, in the 17th century, he was doing also the same. It's all the arts together to make an incredible dinner. And then I understand this like the wedding of opera and gastronomy coming together. You know, this is the thing. And we make this opera in 12 courses. And each course has a story inside.
But you know, Wagner was also a great enthusiast about India and Indian culture. So some Indian food would be good too in your menu. Some esoteric, and look at the colors of the Indian food.
Well, that was a snippet of Liam Aldous's report on the Spanish film El Somni. And of course, you can find out more about that film and the restaurant on this tonight's edition of The Menu, which of course premieres at 1900 hours London time, 1400 hours in New York. And I'm very honored to say that, of course, I'm co-hosting today's show, The Midori House, with the host of The Menu, Marcus.
How exciting is that?
It's very exciting. I always look forward to Fridays when you're here.
Well, I can tell you a couple of more things about that program, because it's quite a good show that is coming up in about 10 hours. We meet Luke Gnayan, who was actually quite a well-known Australian broadcaster, chef, and also an author. He grew up in Australia, in Sydney suburb that was known for his Vietnamese cuisine. And, well, he launched his own restaurant and so on, and after that decided to go to Vietnam to actually see what his cultural heritage is all about.
And he has a very successful series of television shows all about that, doesn't he?
Exactly. He's quite a big name. And indeed, basing on his travels in Vietnam, he's written a book, a massive book, that's quite modestly called The Food of Vietnam.
Very unique. Well, it's our staff lunch today as well, and it's Vietnamese food, isn't it?
Is it really?
Vietnamese bun rolls.
Lucky one. Another story I'd like to mention, we are going to Stockholm to, well, there's a service that is going to make our lives so much easier. You know, all us who have sourdough culture at home.
What's sourdough culture, Marcus?
Sourdough for bread.
Oh, you
right, know,
okay.
When you are baking, you know, when you want to make, for example, in Nordic countries, good rye bread and so on, sourdough culture, you need it. It can survive for years, even generations, if it's looked after properly. But you may accidentally kill it if you go for a holiday and just don't do anything with it.
Therefore, are we talking about the bread?
Yes.
Okay.
Therefore, in Stockholm now, there is a sourdough hotel. You can leave that sourdough there and you don't need to worry about that when you're having your holiday somewhere warm.
But doesn't the sourdough get hard? I don't understand.
You have to listen to the program to find out more, Phil.
And what time is it on again?
It's 1900 hours London time.
Well, I'm very excited. Sourdough, who knew sourdough can keep for years? Well, of course, that is The Menu. 1400 hours also if you're listening from Toronto. Well, in just a moment, we're going to be flicking through this morning's Italian front pages, but we have a song to get us there. This is a special song request from our next guest, David Pleasant, who, of course, will flick through this morning's papers. This is Sparring Partner by the iconic Cantautore with Paolo Conte. Ho guardato in fondo al gioco. That, of course, was the very lovely sounds of Paolo Conte with Sparring Partner. And while that song was playing, Marcus thankfully explained how the yeast hotel, sourdough hotel. So now I understand.
Now you know. And also for your information, you are listening to Midori House with me, Marcus Hippi and Phil Hahn. It's time now to take a look at the Italian press, and we are joined in the studio by Monocle's David Pleasant. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
What do you have for us?
Well, I thought we'd start with yesterday's activities in the centre of Rome. It was actually reported internationally. Obviously quite a big deal on the domestic papers. This was a housing protest, the movement for the home. It's basically people protesting against the very high rents or unaffordable rents and the lack of housing and social housing for a lot of people who are finding themselves in financial difficulty.
How is that problem being tackled in Rome nowadays? What are the local officials doing?
Well, mainly spraying tear gas at protesters, not really helping the situation. The situation did get quite violent at some point. The reason they chose to protest, this was right in the centre of Rome at the Via del Tritone, where they were actually protesting outside the headquarters of ANCI, A-N-C-I, which is the local government, the commune organisation, and they were having their big annual meeting. Inside, another story by the La Repubblica, they were discussing new bike cycle lane proposals for the whole of Italy. So it's a bit of a dichotomy there. The protesters were demonstrating against the kind of local government's inability to deal with rents, high rents and evictions and so on. Inside, on the agenda was cycle lane proposals across the country.
And a rather interesting thing, because, of course, Rome's new mayor, Ignacio Marino, is a very big proponent of cycling around Rome. He actually tries to travel everywhere possible while riding around on a bike. He usually has even a couple policemen riding around with him. So what role is kind of he playing in this discussion and debate?
Well, Funny you should mention that. I was just about to say that he turned up at the protests on his bike, on route to the conference inside the building. He's obviously very pro cycling, but also he stood up for the protesters, saying that that the government should enforce some kind of legislation to help the most vulnerable people from eviction from their housing.
And looking at what was going on inside that building when they were discussing the future of cycling in Italy, in principle, what you've heard of, what the plans are, could that actually change cycling in the country?
Well, despite the fact that perhaps there were more immediate pressing concerns outside the building, inside, that the meeting did come out with some quite interesting proposals. Cycling's kind of gone, as elsewhere in Europe, cycling's really gone mad in Italy, as it were. Many hundreds of thousands of people per month buying bikes and getting to work and their studies and so on by bike. And proposals include changing the highway code of Italy to make it much more bike friendly from the outset. So changing really the way people drive. Obviously, you might imagine Italian roads aren't that accustomed to cycling. Well, sports cycling has always been a huge big deal in Italy, but cycling to commute to work and so on is relatively a new phenomenon.
And if you think about the infrastructure of Rome itself, it is an incredibly chaotic city. You've got, thousands of cars zooming about, thousands of mopeds, scooters, and then to throw in cyclists in the mix, it could be a very dangerous situation, no?
Well, yeah, although, I mean, some of the proposals actually talk about kind of street layouts and urban planning and so on, and they suggest in historic centres, just get rid of cars altogether. Let's just stick with bikes.
David, let's just cover one topic really quickly. I've heard that a lot of Italians are coming to London to divorce.
Yeah, that's right. La Stampa features this story of, it's actually a fraudulent group, quite a large group of 179 Italian couples that have used fraudulent documents to claim that they're resident in the UK to take advantage of the very speedy divorce legislations in the UK, whereas in Italy it can take up to 5 years to process a divorce. In England, it's quite funny, it says that the English, in their pragmatic way, are very quick at divorcing, so that's attracting a lot of Italians.
In a way, I'm quite happy to be in London if that ever happens, that situation in my life. Thank you very much.
And of course, if they can't come to the UK, I hear Romania is also a top destination for Italians to go and get divorced.
You know a lot about this business, don't you?
I've looked into this. You've always got to be prepared. You never know what might happen.
Thank you very much, our own David Pleasant with the Italian Papers.
Unfortunately, though, that is all the time we have for today's program. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denny, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Rujo, and our studio manager, Alex Funnel. Up next, after the news, is Section D, Monocle's design program, and this week it's all about Dutch Design Week. Well, stay tuned for the briefing at midday London time, that's 8 o'clock in New York City, and tune in for Midori House at the same time on Monday. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Marco Sippi, thank you for listening and goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time, it tells history. Rolex.